Ready?
Yep.
Trust your guide.
Trust your guide.
Fish on.
Let me go, baby. Let's go.
Woohoo! Ready to go, Keith?
Oh, baby. Boat-tastic.
No! Oh, Keith.
That was so cool.
Dude, that's a big one.
Oh, yeah. Nice, Jed.
Snort was so intimidating. There can't be another animal in North America that can make a sound remotely like that.
No.
Doesn't get better than that.
But first, a word for our partners.
Alaska Rodco, Alaskan handmade rods.
National Wild Turkey Federation, South Sound Strutters, your conservation organization for Washington State turkey populations and habitats. Shell Art Studio, original Alaskan focused art.
Slay Jays, it ain't all about the catching.
Welcome to another episode of the Young Guides Podcast. I'm Keaton, and today I have Dave Helgeson on. I know Dave from my church. I thought bringing Dave on would be an awesome conversation because he has a lot of backgrounds and years in trailers and RV shows and selling. And then he also has some search and rescue background. So I wanted to dive in, maybe pick his brain, get some essentials on some of the things that you might need when you're going out hunting or fishing this fall or in the summertime, and just what to bring, and maybe you're getting ready to buy your first trailer or, you know, camper or, you know, something along those lines. And we're hoping that this podcast might help you out when you're getting ready to make those choices. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Good to be here.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you get into selling trailers and RVs and all that?
Yeah, I was basically born in it. My grandparents had a dealership they took over from my aunt in 1937. It was called Central Trailer Exchange. My grandfather and then his four sons got into it. It was moved up in the SeaTac area of Washington near the airport. So I was literally born into it. I worked my first RV when I was 8. Started being a lot boy in my teens, progressed to accessory store manager, service manager, mechanic, sales manager, rental manager. Other than bookkeeping, if it involves RV, I've done it.
Wow.
So if it's got wheels underneath it and a toilet inside, I can fix it.
Yeah. And so have you kind of just a little bit back step. So are you from Washington State?
Like, yes, I'm a native. I was born and raised in Washington, Washington.
Cool. So just kind of, it's been in your family for a long time, and you just kind of pursued it. And that was it. You said your parents did it as well.
My grandparents followed my father, and that's where I got my start. And I missed, actually, my wife and I started our own dealership in 1989 and pursued that. Then we turned into doing RV shows. And that turned into now speaking and help and going to other RV events and sharing my knowledge. Yeah, so
that's cool. So I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you had some search and rescue background. Have you always done that? Even
not always. You know, I've always done outdoor stuff. And a little background on that. My brother had a private plane, which he crashed in 1993. We could not locate the locator beacon. So Civil Air Patrol was instrumental in that and eventually finding him. And several years later, my son turned 16, can't remember the right year. He could apply for the 4x4 Division of Search and Rescue. My dad had been a volunteer firefighter for all his life and says, you know, you'll like that. You should join with him. So I did. So that's where I got in search and rescue. I've been there now 20 plus years since. So it teaches a lot of background skills, a lot I already knew. But since, you know, I'm born and raised in Washington, I know the area well. We get a call, I kind of get an idea what's involved, and maybe I've already been there once. So
yeah. So what does search and rescue entail? You've talked to me before at church that you do a lot of training, and then do you guys have like when you go to a search and rescue call, do you have a certain role that you do in your search and rescue call?
Typically, there's 9 divisions in King County search and rescue. There's the foot teams, there's ski patrol, there's 2 dog units, there's a horse unit, There's 4x4, which is 4x4 trucks, help with transport and communications. Then it's called RSVU, which is Regional Specific Vehicles Unit, which involves snowmobiles, dirt bikes, and quads. I'm in both the 4x4 and the RSVU. I would probably be in the foot guys, the what's called ESAR. But the training was so much more extensive, I literally didn't have time to do it.
Yeah.
So I stick to the vehicles. But a lot of training. You know, you have wilderness first aid, map and compass. I can't even think of them all right now. Helicopter, safely being around a helicopter, set up a landing zone.
Yeah. That's pretty
cool. A lot of training. And when you get to a mission, the on-site deputy will typically assign, he'll assign, there'll be a unit leader, or if it's a big thing, there'll be a command vehicle that oversees all the different units, and they'll see what your expertise is. They might, if I have the ATV or snowmobile with me, they might dispatch me that way. Maybe they need a lot of people transported, I'll transport people in my truck, or it might just be supplies, if it's rigging for like a rope rescue. And so you do what you're told, basically.
Yeah, that's cool. So is King County, do you stick to most like King County search and rescue, or you're across the state, or do you mostly stick to?
Well, we're trained for King County, but since we're the largest in the state, actually the most specialized, other counties will request our assistance quite often. Okay. They had a, can't be specific on this one, but there was a search they were asking for over in the, I believe it was the Kittasic County area. So they'll have asked for help in evidence searches. They have a big, you might recall, need a big response. There was a fire, I believe, captain missing over off of 410, three winters ago now. They were asking for units every morning for a week on that one, from all divisions. They wanted, we have a drone unit too. So they asked for drones, 4x4s, ATVs, foot, horse, dogs, whatever. And that was ongoing for quite a, unfortunately, I was still doing shows at the time, couldn't respond. But locally, while they were, most of the teams were over there, they need some people to help with a metal detecting evidence search. So I thought, well, there's nobody else. So I rolled locally on stuff while that big search was going on.
So are you guys provided the equipment that you need for search and rescue, or a lot of?
A little bit. People don't understand is we're strictly volunteer. We typically supply all our own equipment. So the truck, ATV, motorcycle, and you see the motorcycle and ATV back of my truck in my background picture. We get our own packs, our own, almost all of our equipment. You got to buy the radios, the survival gear you're required to carry. Now, the last bond that passed, I'm sketching the details. There was a parks bond, where there was $100,000 assigned for all the units of search and rescue in King County. Wow. So there might be a little stuff. Some of the units might own some equipment they got through grants. Like RSVU does own a two quads that were provided by grants that I could use. Yeah. I like to run my own equipment because I'm familiar with it. If you're on a mission that exceeds 100 miles or takes you out of county, they will pay your gas. You got to submit a claim form to the Office of Emergency Management of the state and be prepared to wait about 6 months to get your money back. Or if you damage yourself or your vehicle, you're covered. Same thing. If you're on a mission that's been authorized by the deputy and you become injured, you get a free trip to Harborview to fix. If your vehicle gets injured, it gets documented on site. And then once it's repaired, they'll look at the claim and either approve it or deny it or pay part of it.
Wow, that's cool.
So otherwise, it's all out of pocket.
So search and rescue, I mean, it's pretty much all volunteer-based, right?
All volunteer, yeah.
And then who are you getting, who's providing the training for you?
There's a King County Search and Rescue Organization covers all the units, and they line up the training, and it is provided free. Sometimes it's with other search and rescue people that have been in a long time or deemed experts at it, that they spend their time. There's some online training that's out of and available we can take online for free, but it's there's just a whole plethora of ways to stay trained. When you're brand new, it's almost all in-person training, so you got to go to a lot of classes. Some's taught by the deputies, but most of it's search and rescue, other search and rescue people are experts in their field.
Yeah, that's cool. So having the background and doing search and rescue for many years, what are some things that you feel like are essential when you're going out, you know, on a search, or if you're, you know, maybe we can some essentials for like going out, backpacking, hunting, fishing. What do you recommend?
For starters, look up the 10 essentials. Okay. Anybody going backcountry should have them, and probably half our rescues wouldn't happen if people were carrying the 10 essentials. Yeah. And I can't name from memory, but it's like a flashlight, map and compass, some rain gear. Don't be wearing cotton, especially in the Northwest. You get rained on, because cotton equals hypothermia. Gets wet, you stay wet, you get cold. So most people don't have, they didn't, especially in the fall when they don't estimate the nights coming early. They're out there without a light. They can't find their way back to trailhead. They don't have a compass or a good map, so they can't reorient once they get off trail. Some survival food, some rain gear. Look up 10 essentials, carry that. One other thing I highly recommend, and I've been running with for over 10 years now, it's called, mine's a spot beacon. It's called a satellite messenger beacon. Garmin makes one. There's some other ones entering the market now. But you could send a distress call from anywhere, virtually anywhere in the world, but anywhere in North America. You get to the North Pole, it gets a little sketchy, but you should have more than just that. And you can, the newer ones allow for two-way communication. You can either have a keypad like a Spot X, or the Garmin, you can Bluetooth to your phone and use a keypad on your phone. So you can literally, if you have an emergency situation, relay that right to first responders, what your problem is. Are you injured? Are you out of supplies? Are you lost? Gets them more prepared to respond to the field and let you know help's coming.
Yeah.
It really is a lifesaver. There's been cases where people, if you go to the Spot site, it'll tell you like there's 8,000 rescues and counting that have been initiated through that. Quite often, we'll get nothing more than, there's an overdue hiker. We're not really sure where they went, but they're supposed to leave from this trailhead. It doesn't give us a lot of information. So you have to start covering all the trails from where the person was last seen. We're going, hey, they're specifically going to this spot. We got a spot beacon from this location. Here's what the problem is. And the deputy running the show to start with has a lot better idea of what resources are needed.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. Who would have thought that's like what it entailed, and that's like, you wouldn't think about all that stuff when you hear search and rescue, you know?
So number one, if you don't have communications in the field, let somebody know where you're going and when you plan to return. Yeah. That gives us what we do. You see my background picture, that's in Utah. When we travel big trips down the Southwest, don't know exactly where we're going to end up. Definitely not every night, because we boondock, which is dispersed camping for free on public land.
Yeah.
So it's kind of freewheeling it. On the spot beacon, there's a button we can push every night that says, just checking in, we're okay. So every night when we check in, our adult children know where we are, where we ended up that day. We have a rough itinerary of the sites we're going to see along the way. So we don't check in the next night. They call search and rescue. Hey, our parents didn't check in tonight. Here's where they camped last. Here's the things they're going to see today. And they're going to camp somewhere in this area and they haven't checked in. That's enough information to initiate a search.
Yeah.
If search and rescue gets a call, well, my parents were camping somewhere in Utah and we haven't heard from a couple days. Guess what? The deputy is not going to initiate a search because he has nothing to start with.
Yeah.
You need at least a point last seen.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of those where people just get out and, I'm not going to get lost. I'm not going to get stuck in the mud. You know, my vehicle's not going to break. Death Valley is a prime example of that.
Yeah.
People get out and they don't have enough water and they dehydrate. They just literally die out there.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I just say let somebody know where you're coming, where you're going to come back. A starting point's important. Carry the 10 essentials. It'll keep you out of a lot of trouble and know your limits.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And I think those Garmin inreaches, can't you also just send, like, if you're out of service range, you can also send text messages through them?
Right. That's the thing. If that's the spot where, as long as you have satellite coverage. So if you're in heavy trees, you just got to get out in the open.
Yeah.
We both work on lower orbiting satellites. So regardless of your cell phone service or not, you can send a message. 140 characters on a spot. I think inReach is about the same thing.
Yeah.
So you can text out a message and say, hey, I fell and broke my ankle or broken axle on the truck and it's not field repairable. We need to be extracted. We need help.
Yeah.
We ran out of food. We got struck by lightning. We caught in a blizzard on top of Mount Rainier. Prime example, my son and I climbed Mount Rainier probably 7 years ago. Now we summited all the normal stuff. We're coming down. We're near Camp Muir, and there's a Chinook helicopter circling the mountain. Thought, great, somebody fell in a crevasse. It's going to be all over the morning news. My wife's going to freak out. Well, I already sent a spot message beacon when we summited like 5 a.m. in the morning. So she knew we reached the summit. Yeah. But I thought, if this is a true search and it's on the news, anybody knows I'm on the mountain's going to be, you know, hey, is Dave okay? Is Dave okay? So I just sent another spot message says, checking in, I'm okay. So knew I hadn't fallen in a crevasse. You know? Yeah. Turned out they're just up there practicing, we found out later. But
oh, they're just,
who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. Do you stuff like that? I mean, do they call in like the National Guard for rescues like on Rainier or up in high elevations?
That's going to be left to the ranger at the park. Typically, they'll at high altitude, they'll need a Chinook helicopter because conventional helicopters don't have enough lift at high altitudes to extract somebody. But if they think it's not high winds or something, they'll have a ground team. They have park rangers that maybe on occasion they might call the Seattle Ski Patrol as part of search and rescue in that has you know snow potential and knows how to rope up and get places safely. They make that call.
Oh, that's cool. So kind of going away from search and rescue, growing up, I mean, I'm sure having family in the trailer business and stuff that you go out camping and outdoors a lot, so you have quite a bit of experience out boondocking and just kind of setting up camp in places that maybe not others would choose to do so, right?
I'm definitely a non-conventional camper. Once our kids, you know, when the kids were younger, we typically stayed in campgrounds. But now, a good almost 20 years ago now, we realized that because we traveled a lot, once the kids were out of the house, we started traveling a lot in areas we hadn't been to. And it's like, and we like to visit non-conventional places. Let's ghost towns, old mining camps, slot canyons, unique geological formations, maybe old Pony Express station. Typically, there wasn't a campground anywhere within miles. Yeah. Yeah. So we learned quickly about dispersed camping or what RVers call boondocking. It's not just dry camping in a campground. It's finding a spot for free on public land that allows dispersed camping, which in the 11 Western states, there's tons of spaces. So we do that a lot now, because like I said, we tend to camp in areas where there's not, you know, it's not next to Disneyland or it's not next to some theme park. Yeah. We like it out in the wild. That's and cool. There's conventionally not a campground or not a campground we want to be in, or in the case of the dirt bike and the quad, not all states are we legal to ride from maybe a campground. Yeah. Typically when we disperse camp, I can disperse camp close enough we can legally ride the dirt bike and quad when we need to.
Yeah.
It gets us closer to our destination right off the bat.
Well, that's cool. So getting into dispersed camping, dry camping, how do you kind of pick out the right trailer? I see in the background, it looks like a fifth wheel, or you got a pretty...
It's a travel trailer with more than average clearance. You know, anybody can do it. I present a boondocking 101 class called Finding a Place to Camp. And probably 90% of the spots we've end up camping, you could get there with a two-wheel drive motorhome.
Yeah.
But having a little bit of clearance and four-wheel drive, guess what? Gives you more options.
Yeah.
And sometimes a little more confidence than you should have. So clearance is good if you're getting off trail ways.
Yeah.
Four-wheel drive, obviously, especially in Utah, if it rains, that stuff turns to gumbo mud. And two-wheel drive, you're gonna get stuck fast.
Yeah.
So for the RV, obviously, if you're gonna stay out for a while, water is the number one thing you're gonna run out of. So our current travel trailer picture there has a 60-gallon fresh water tank. A lot of RVs only have a 40. We can get by with 6 to 10 gallons a day for conserving. If we know we're going to be somewhere really long, we just take like extra 5 gallon jugs with us. So fresh water is number one. The second is the gray tank capacity. That's the water from the shower, the sink, both sinks, kitchen sink, bathroom sink, and then of course the shower. Of course, black water, which is sewage, you can't legally dump anywhere. Some spots you can still legally dispose of gray water, or if you're ultra conservative, dish water, depending on the range you talk to, you're always legal to dump that on a bush. So if you catch the water when you're doing dishes in a dish pan, that can be taken right outside and dumped. So conserving the gray water is the next thing will force you up. When it's filled up, it's time to go. Black water, I think we have a 40-gallon black tank. That's weeks of using them, because, you know, typically if you're an outdoors person, as you know, Keaton, you're out away from the base anyway, so you're using what nature supplies for a bathroom. So that doesn't fill up very quickly.
No.
So then it's this battery capacity. You need power to run things, you know, to conserve. And so lithium batteries are getting to be a really good option, backed up by solar. Mm-hmm. I haven't gone there yet because I'm pretty stingy when it comes to power. So I still have 2 12-volt lead acid batteries, but I will probably be going lithium soon if the prices continue to drop.
Yeah.
So adequate water, good power source, and we have a generator on board too, which brings power back up. And some tweaks to the system that conserve power inside, you can be out for a long time. In fact, we took a trip last year in August. We went to the wilds of southern Idaho, probably about 70 miles east of Sun Valley. Beautiful mm-hmm. area, about 7,000 feet. And no cell phone service, no improvements in anything. We dispersed camp for 9 days, took extra water and fuel with us, and no problem.
Yeah.
No problem. So other than the remnants of Hurricane Hillary came through one day. and luckily, again, no internet either. I use my spot beacon to ask for updates from my adult children. In 140 characters, tell me what's forthcoming in the weather.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, we better move to a high spot. The remnants of Hurricane Hillary come through where it's going to get wet.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You get some crazy winds coming through there too, or?
We didn't get much winds with that, but we've been out where it's been windy before. We've been in Death Valley where we've had wind storms. We were near the Imperial Dunes once. It's the largest sand dune system in the United States,
mm-hmm.
Where we got a good blow. And I don't care how tight people say RVs, the sand will get in your windows. So afterwards, we're down near the Salton Senior Town came up, and it was I can't think of the name right now, but the wind was still blowing. So we found a big box store that was deserted, but had a big asphalt parking lot that wasn't windy or wasn't sandy. We opened up all the windows, turned sideways the wind, took everything out, beat it, let the wind blow through the trailer to get rid of the sand and put it back together. Plus, I have a small 12-volt vacuum we use too. So,
yeah. What about, I mean, you mentioned, you know, having a generator, carrying extra water and stuff. How do you make sure that you have the space to carry all that, plus all the essentials that you're going to need, like your food, your clothing?
So the back of the truck, you can't see it in this the background picture. I've made a box because, you know, a quad's about 6 feet long, a motorcycle's about 7 feet long. If you put them all to the front, you got to unload all that junk before you take your machines out, right? So I made a box when it goes across the front of the truck that will hold, typically run with 10 gallons of spare fuel, but I can run as much as 20 gallons of spare fuel in there. Tire chains in case you get in a snowy condition or a muddy situation. Lubricants for the machines. The box is elevated, so the ramps that the machine's going out of can slide in underneath it. So a lot of it goes in there. When we're going to go somewhere super dry, if I carry extra water, it will nestle down on the running boards on the ATV, and I can strap it in place. And we get the side ice pull it out. Generator, I made a special compartment, not a compartment, but a stand. It can ride behind the propane bottles in front of the trailer. It's strapped down, has a cover. So it's not taking up valuable space. And like I said, the fuel's in the back of the truck. It's still a gasoline generator. Propane is a conversion option, but I don't have that.
Yeah.
So gas is there. The water tank in the trailer is under floor, so it ain't up a lot of space. It's mounted above the axle. So, you know, you be wise on what you carry. Know you're going to use it. You know, I have the backseat of the truck, which sometimes we'll pack extra gear in. Before we go out, Sherry, my wife, you know her, if we're going on a long trip, she might bake a lasagna and divide it up into servings for two in brick size. And, you know, brick size stuff is real good in a square freezer or rectangular freezer.
Yeah.
So she'll play Tetris on the freezer. And typically we can go 2 to 3 weeks without stopping to buy any meat. It's all frozen on board. Canned goods, you know, non-perishable goods. Produce is a problem. After about a week, you might run out of produce. You know, can't always find it. So,
yeah.
But you learn quickly what's important, what's not. Take the good stuff, leave the fluff.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, and since we do ride motorcycles and ATVs in dusty conditions, I've more than once gone out and beat our clothes on a rock in a creek and hung them to dry because it's like, they're dirty. I'm not wearing this again. So you learn, you know, you go back to what our forefathers did in their wagons.
Yeah.
Same things are available.
It's all out there. It's nature's washer and dryer, right?
That's right. It is. So
that's cool. What about like if you're on the fence between like a trailer and a camper, right? Does that come down to like the individual and kind of what they do? I see you talk about having dirt bikes and stuff in the back here, in your truck, but also like, you know, if I'm a fisherman and I got a boat, I can't tow a trailer, right? But
right. So you'd have to go to maybe a motorhome.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, type of RVs is a great thing. And when we're doing shows, when I give interviews, people expected me to have a big Class A. I said, it doesn't fit my lifestyle at this point in my life. As you see, the dirt bike and the quad are very important to have with us. We use them a lot. I looked at a toy hauler type RV where it has the garage in the back. They're heavier. The problem is you can't always park that where you can legally ride the ATV and motorcycle from. Motorcycle's dual sports. I could, but laws vary from all 50 states on where you can legally ride an ATV. So in Washington, many times where you could legally camp, you can't legally ride the ATV to the nearest trail that it's legal on. So having the back of my truck, we always take the truck to trailhead. So that's part of the reason we didn't want a toy hauler. Plus, if you're still running a two-stroke machine, two-strokes stink. I don't care what you do. You put it in a living space, you're going to smell it. So we didn't want a garage a two-stroke machine. We're both four strokes now, but we also snowmobile, which are two strokes. And had we decided to take a snowmobile, so right now, truck trailer is the best thing for me. And I like it to the lunar landing. You know, we get to a spot, we jettison the trailer. We take off with the truck, the ATV and the quad in the back, and food. And we always keep a case of water in the back of the truck.
Yeah.
So we get to a point where the road becomes too rough to the truck, or maybe it's not a legal road anymore. We jettison the truck and continue on the ATV and the motorcycle. We might run that to where they're not legal anymore, edge of wilderness or national park, a back entrance. For example, Arches National Park has a back entrance. Most people know. We rode literally to the fence line, jettisoned the machines and walked in the back of the park. Now on the back of the ATV, there's also another case that contains first aid gear and water and more survival gear. So yeah. We continue on foot with a backpack on. So we have the fallback points. If anything were to fail, we can fall back on a thing.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned truck camper. Now, if you got any Eastern followers in the Eastern, a lot of people back there will call any type RV a camper, trailer, fifth wheel, call it a camper. So we'll be specific here. It's a truck camper that goes on the back of a pickup truck. And in the late 60s, those were the most popular type of RV out there. Everybody had experience that was a youth back then, has fond memories of riding in the overhead cab of the truck camper. Yeah. And when we had our dealership, we took them on for a while and we'd get people all the time. Oh, yeah, such fond memories of any truck camper. Well, truck campers aren't as cheap as they once were. They'll typically cost twice what equivalent travel trailer will. So people say, why are they so expensive? And the first thing I would ask them, just so you point out, are you going to pull a boat trailer? Are you pulling something? Well, no, I just want an RV to pull behind, use with my truck. Then you don't want to necessarily want a truck camper. Let's look at a travel trailer. It's a lot less money, gives you more floor space.
Yeah.
Your case, if you're pulling a boat and you definitely might get off road to go up to a mountain lake or somewhere where you don't want to take a motor home, which that throws out of the option. A truck camper makes a lot more sense. Conversely, if you're really a serious backcountry type, a travel trailer has limitations. How far are you going to pull it in the backcountry? A truck camper on a good stop four-wheel drive truck, you can go just about anywhere the truck can, as long as it's not too off camera, you're going to roll it over.
Yeah.
There's been spots, especially getting down in the Death Valley area spots, where there might be an old ghost town or mining camp that's 50, 60 miles off the pavement. I'd really like to go there. It's an awful long run to take the quad and the bike round trip in a day. It'd really be nice to have a truck camper and spend, you can go 30 miles the first day, camp, and do the other 30 miles the next day. And many of those are through roads where you might pop out on the other side and see a bunch more stuff.
Yeah.
That's where it'd be nice to have a four-wheel drive truck with a truck camper or a four-wheel drive fast B van.
Yeah.
Then you're not have to return. Like I mentioned, jettisoning the parts along the way, you could keep going. I'd still probably want a dirt bike on the back of a van or a truck camper. Just in case something broke, I'd have a way to get out.
Yeah. That's cool. You don't really think about all those things when you're going out.
Yeah. I'll tell you one other story real quick in relation to that. So in Northern Death Valley, a spot called the Racetracks, where the rocks move on their own. They just recently figured out there's a light frost that fills and the wind blows it. And the Rangers really tried to discourage people from going back there because it's 26 miles, a very rough road, sharp rocks, it eats tires, and they get way too many rescues back there, and there's no cell phone coverage. So I inquired about it 1 year, and I said, well, you know, I said, I got a four-wheel drive truck with 10-ply tires. I have a dirt bike and quad in the back. I'm licensed in search and rescue, survival trainings, and I have a spot beacon. Well, I guess you can go. And he says, you know, that ATV is not legal in the park. I said, if it's a matter between starving to death, becoming dehydrated, or getting a ticket from you, I'm riding out. Well, I see your point. So
yeah.
Now back to the other types of RVs. There's fifth wheels, motorhomes. Fifth wheels are typically a more stable platform on a pickup truck. Of course, you have to have a pickup truck. So if you have an SUV and you want to pull something right off the bat, you discount that. Problem with fifth wheels is since that's over the bed of your truck, your articulation is really reduced, either going over a steep thing like a set of railroad tracks or articulating through like you're familiar with tank traps that have been dug out there. Items that get filled in, they're traversable with the right vehicle. But for side-to-side motion, you can hit the bed rails of the truck. Yeah. Where a travel trailer on a ball can articulate, you know, 30 degrees separate from the tow vehicle. So there have been spots where I've gone through tank traps that have been kind of filled in, run over. I wish I had videos because the truck's going this way and the travel trailer's going this way. And just go through slowly, know your clearance, and you're good.
Yeah.
But fifth wheels typically will give you more floor space because they make them bigger. Your truck can handle more weight because you can put more weight on the kingpin instead of a tow ball. So they're definitely an option if you can do a lot of full-time or serious boondocking. Your water tanks will be bigger and your reserve holding gray tank might be bigger.
Yeah.
Motorhomes, again, class C is your one mounted on a typical van chassis. They'll work for dry camping. Again, typically don't have a lot of clearance. They do make four-wheel drive versions that are fairly pricey, Super C's on big truck chassis. I don't want to spend that kind of money. Class A's typically don't have the clearance. But as I mentioned, probably 90% of the spots that we drive, you get Class A. In fact, I'm going to write an article. Somebody posted on one of the Facebook things I'm part of for RVTravel.com. And I'm going to write an article. Yes, big rigs can boondock too. And here's what you look for. you just want to know what your clearance issues are. And there's a way to tell that in advance if you get good at looking at Google Earth and stuff.
Yeah. Man, you talked about taking your truck. And I was amazed by taking your truck and trailer. And you're like, oh, yeah, the truck's going this way and the trailer's going that way.
Because it will articulate on the ball.
Yeah.
And think about it. It's just a round tow ball, the coupler on it. It could.
And most trailers are pretty much straight axled, right, underneath?
There's what's called a drop axle, which is deceiving. Okay. They're the lower clearance ones. You can do what's called an axle flip, which is in a snowbird. You actually – drop axles are typically mounted over the leaf spring. So you just take them out, weld a new saddle on, put it under the leaf spring. That'll gain you 4 inches. Mine does have a straight axle, which was originally mounted under the leaf springs. You know, some manufacturers put a straight axle on, it's over the leaf spring. So in all cases, you can – take an axle out, drop it under the leaf spring, gain clearance.
Yeah.
Fifth wheels, that's quite often dumb because, you know, Fords, especially Fords, keep getting taller and taller, and fifth wheel manufacturers weren't keeping up. And if you hooked onto them, the fifth wheel way tall on the nose. So typically when we're selling fifth wheels, we'd have to do an axle flop right off the bat because, A, it would be too high in the nose and might hit the tail end of the truck where the tailgate was. So It's very common to do axle flips. But at some point you get so high, then your steps don't reach the ground on your door side. So there's things to keep in consideration. So I could still, if I wanted to, I could do, you know, I could block the axle, get more clearance. It's very rare we have a clearance issue going in somewhere.
Yeah.
I should have shot videos of some spots we've accessed through the years.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, last year coming out of the spot, in one of the spots in Idaho I told you about. We went out a different way, went in, and I did briefly catch my front jacks on a rock. I had to back out, take another line out it. Because our manufacturer put the jacks under the front A-frame instead of tucked them back 6 inches farther where they'd be under the back upstep. They have 6 inches more protection behind the frame. And I've threatened numerous times to cut them off and re-weld them there. So when I permanently damage them and get a new set, I will. But until then, they can hang out in the front. But
that's cool. So there's... Is there like a a whole kind of market for modifying your trailers. Like, can you do different things to your trailers, or do you recommend doing things, or having, like, is there professionals that can do some change up on your trailers?
You know, most dealers could do most changes if they understand what your objective is. Most any RV can make boondocking ready without a bunch of things. Things I've done to mine is there's a circuit on the refrigerator. It's basically a little heating strip behind the refrigerator door that it runs to remove condensation, so you don't get a little bit of condensation behind your door when you open. But guess what? It pulls 24 amps a day out of your battery. That's half the capacity of a deep cycle battery. So guess what? I have a switch. I disable it when we're dry camping. I turn it off because that will run the furnace for 4 or 5 hours. I'd rather have 4 or 5 hours of furnace runtime than a little moisture behind my refrigerator door. Yeah. So it's things like that. I've modified the air conditioner, what's called a soft start RV, which drops the start amperage down by over 50%. So it's happened to carry a big, heavy generator. Like most people do, I can start my generator at higher altitudes with a 2,200 watt Honda generator, where most people have to carry a 3,000, 3,500. I could actually do it closer to sea level with 2,000 watt. But as we know, internal combustion engines get less efficient at higher altitudes. And that's self, takes care of itself, because when you get up 10,000 feet, guess what? You're not going to need an air conditioner typically. It's going to be cool enough. So that's one of the mods. You know, I've got some water saving things I've done. I've changed out the LED lights all the way through it. New RVs come with them anyway. They pull less power. So it's just maximizing your water, minimizing your 12 volt use is the main things. And then if you want to do something with clearance, you know, you could have the axles flipped. Not a lot you can do with motorized RVs inexpensively, because there's, you know, raising the front suspension is almost impossible without spending a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And it's kind of counterproductive. So
that's kind of why everyone does like vans and stuff, right? Because it's a little easier and probably a little more price acceptable to lift a van.
Well, converting vans is. You buy a pre-made Class B van conversion, you're going to start $100,000, probably more like $150,000. So wow. They're quite luxurious, and yeah, they're not exactly inexpensive though. You get what we call a stick and tin travel trailer, which mine is. It's got aluminum skin over a wood frame. You can run the tar out of it, you know, and get most of your money back and go to sell it. You can get a good stick and tin trailer right now for without a slide out for 25, 30 grand, with a slide out for 30 to 40 grand.
Yeah.
You know, give you an idea, the trailer I'm running now, we're in less than $14,000 and it doesn't owe me anything. I'm on the second set of running gear on it.
Yeah.
And unlike a motorhome that has an odometer, you can run a trailer to death. You take care of it. When you go to sell it, you put new tires on. It's worth, you know, one that's got 100,000 miles worth just as much as the one's got 10,000 miles if you've taken care of it, because there's no odometer to depreciate it. No.
So after you've gone on a long trip, what kind of things do you do to make sure that you're keeping, you know, it up to maintenance, and then also like keeping it clean and making it last longer?
Main thing is, you know, is when we're on a trip, is making note of things that have maybe failed or need fixing. There's been more than once we've done field repairs to keep going. Luckily I've had that background. Give you an example, not far from the picture, background picture is our water heater failed, and we were out. We're way out in the boonies. And it's like, well, this is a bummer. Well, it uses a 12-volt valve to open the gas valve. And it's a redundant valve that uses windings to create magnetism to pull the valve open. Well, one of the windings had failed. And here's the disclaimer. I don't recommend anybody to do this. But I determined one of the windings was bad. I took it apart to see if I could solder it back up. I do carry a soldering iron. I can plug it into the generator. And determined that the electromagnet was bad. It's like, I also prospect for gold. I have a pick with a rare earth magnet in the bottom of it. And I discovered by applying the magnet where the electromagnet was, I can open the valve. I still have the electromagnet to manually open and close it as the water heater called for. So I just defeated one of the redundancy safeties. It was still safe to use because, again, the other magnet was working. The electromagnet was working, open, close the valve. So when we got the cell phone service, I called the dealer. It says, do you have this part in stock? Yes. I called an RV park in Moab, Utah. Said, can I have something shipped to you? They said, yep. I said, we'll be there in, you know, 4 or 5 days. We'll get a spot for the night. Do you care if I do the repair in your park? They said, no. So got there, the part was there, did the field repair, and we were back out in the boonies. So wow. Done that with the furnace. I've done that there's ways to override the electronic brain in your refrigerator to keep it operating. So do the field repairs. I can't get the part while we're on the road. When I get home, I make the fix. So
that's great.
One more fun story. Year of COVID, 2020, we're heading to Baker County, Oregon. Lowest rate of COVID anywhere. They hadn't had any, in fact, they hadn't had any cases when we left. I thought, okay, well, that's where we're going. And we were going to go be in the backcountry for quite a while. Got water outside of LeGrand at a rest area there, pulled forward, and all of a sudden there's water running all over the ground. Luckily, we're traveling with friends that had stopped to let them feel it. Our underfloor water tank, the wells had taken, had dropped out onto the axles. I thought, well, we're done. Started a 2-week trip, no water, no boondocking. Luckily, we drained the tank, resecured it. There happened to be a DOT employee there working on the rest area. I said, where's the nearest open hardware store on a Sunday? I said, LeGrand or Baker City. He says, Baker City. Went there as an Ace Hardware. Luckily, we found a shady spot off to one side to pull the trailer. Went in there, bought hacksaw, steel, nuts and bolts, and managed to bolt the water tank back in place. They also had an outsized hose bib by their loading dock that hadn't been used in a century, but ran the rusty water, filled the tank to test it. We were good to go. And then when I got home, obviously, we took out the field repair and I welded things back up the way it's supposed to be. But yeah. Finding a welder on a Sunday in the Grand or Baker City was not an option. No. Nor would he might not feel comfortable welding that close to plastic. So,
yeah, that's so crazy.
And I do carry spare parts too for the idea when something does fail, you know, some spare wire, good old duct tape.
Yeah. I mean,
nuts and bolts. And I do carry bits for my cordless drill and a soldering iron.
That's crazy. So and that's just fun experience, right? I mean, just things.
It all comes down to experience.
Yeah.
If you know how the systems work, you can diagnose them and do it. And I, of course, keep a voltometer with me too. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely, if you don't know what you're doing, it's probably not recommended out.
Right. No, right. Because again, if you, the backlog getting RV dealerships right now is 2 or 3 weeks. So literally, if you have a major failure on a trip, you're done.
Yeah.
Realistically, unless you know how to fix it yourself.
Yeah.
That's override it.
Wow. That's cool. That's yeah. a lot of time and background out in,
All I know, I've been in all my life. I've been a mechanic. I've been a service manager. I still present seminars at RV rallies, so and shows.
Yeah, you said you write some articles, right?
I write for rvtravel.com and I write for the RV Life umbrella websites, include RV Life, Let's RV, Do It Yourself RV, RV Living. There's a couple others, I can't name them all.
Yeah,
I started blogging for RV Life in 2008. At that time, I didn't know what's a blog. I am in my 60s, so
yeah.
And RV Life, I've known the founder of that for years, and he started, I don't know, 5 years ago. Says you need to write for me, so I do.
That's cool.
So I like I said, I like to share my knowledge because there's so much bad information out there that gives RVing a bad name. And being that I grew up in the industry and think it's a great industry, I like to kind of be an ambassador for the industry where I can. So they need a cheerleader.
Are you now? Are you like retired, or are you still kind of doing it here and there when you can? Part time retired.
Well, I thought I officially retired in the fall of 2022, and it wasn't. My wife and I told ourselves we're not gonna consider anything for a year. We're just gonna take it easy for a year. And I got a call from another show promoter that says, "Dave, there's a manufactured home shop in Biloxi, Texas, not Biloxi, Mississippi." He says, "I need your help." And I said, well, you know, he says, and it's like, all right, he made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So that came on the table. And then FMCA, which is the Family Motor Coach Association, I'd spoken at their events before. They've asked me to return to a couple of events and speak. And then there's other show promoters that say, we'd really like to have come speak at our show. So I'm still writing. So retired, kind of, just call it freelance work.
Yeah, cool.
If it appeals to me, like the RV seminars, I can tell people, if I can get paid to travel the country, go see a part of the country I haven't been in before, present a seminar, put tax and metro days on the end and come out ahead, works for me.
That's a win, right?
It's a win-win for everybody. They get so many knowledgeable things. I get to see a part of the country I haven't seen before.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
What? So here's a question for you. If you had to pick a one specific brand of trailers that is like tailored to outdoorsmen, which one would you pick? And more specifically, what kind, like what trailer would you pick?
That's a loaded question. You know that.
Oh yeah.
The problem with manufacturers, they shouldn't be called manufacturers. They should call other than like Airstream or some very specific ones, they should be called assemblers. Because guess what? Yeah. It's like a home builder. They always use the same parts. They go buy their lumber over here. They buy their water heater over here.
Yeah.
They buy their furnace over here, and they compile them into an RV. So there's nothing unique about the component pieces. They didn't make any of them, disassemble them. You know, and you know, one might say they have better quality than the other. It depends if they're built on a Friday or on a Monday. Being in the RV business, you could see the quality on any brand go up and down depending on if the economy is getting good and they're putting on extra crews. You can tell when your RV was built by a new crew rather than a seasoned crew. During COVID, and they're pumping out the door as fast as they can. Luckily, we didn't buy one during, but I've heard quality fell quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to recommend one building over there. Most all of them are built under what's called the RVIA seal. It's a Recreational Vehicles Institute Association. There's a seal by the door. It says they're a member and they agree to abide by their standards. Know where their standards really posted, but it's better than ones. I honestly say it's better than ones that were built by ones that don't have an RV seal, which isn't many, but the ones I've seen weren't quality. So like I said, I grew up selling Airstream. So Airstream is a solid, well-built trailer, but it's not in a lot of people's budget because, you know, they're $100,000 and up.
Yeah.
A quick story for you. In 1970, when the first Airstream retailed for over $10,000, my granduncle who worked for my grandpa says, we're done. We might as well shut the doors because nobody's going to pay $10,000 for a travel trailer. It just won't happen. Well, nowadays you can't buy.
Yeah.
kind of humorous where we are today, but. You know, we took our honeymoon in an Airstream. They do manufacture a lot of their parts. They do have tolerances. You know, of course, they're all riveted together like an airplane, so they're unlikely to come apart. But all the rest of them, somebody else's components, they're disassembling them. Some have better reviews than others. I'd say get online, do your research. You know, I'm partial to the Outdoors RV product, which is made in La Grande, Oregon. I recommend it to our friends who travel with us. Unfortunately, they got one that was maybe built during a Friday. It's like when it came in, he showed me what was wrong. It's like, I was embarrassed that I recommended the product.
Yeah.
Now, since then I've looked at them, it seems like they've got it together again. But
yeah,
you know, so something I thought, I knew the owner, his standards were good. You know, he wasn't in charge when he had a stroke a number of years back, but I thought maybe the people that were carrying on his tradition were doing things right. But for example, before the roof membrane was a rubber they put down over plywood. They didn't bother to sweep the roof before they put the rubber down. You can see, you know, splinters of plywood, dust, other bits and under the rubber. It's like, it takes what, 10 seconds to blow it off the compressed air or 2 minutes to sweep it?
Yeah.
You know, and there's some things that are out of square. It's like, yeah, that's inexcusable. So.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So And there used to be places out that rate them, and it was funny. There was one brand of trailers. I'll name the name because they don't build any Comfort Travel Trailers, which I enjoyed. We sold a lot of them. And we also sold the Skyline product under the brand name of Nomad. And there was a rating company at the time that said, Comforts were the best ever, which I love to hear. But our mechanics all said, what are they looking at? And the Skyline wasn't so rated, which they had a lot less warranty claims on. So it's all who's looking at them, what unit got built when. So if you're in the market, you know, read the blogs, read the comments, go into an RV show wide open, know what to look for as far as quality, you know, look in the cabinets, look under with the you know, we call flash and trash sometimes, look past the shiny stuff, look in behind how the cabinets are assembled, how they're attached, look the workmanship.
That's awesome.
There'll be some telltale clues of, yeah, I'm not really crazy how this one was assembled.
Yeah.
Our current travel trailer went in once under warranty. It was things I could have fixed, but it was under warranty. And I got a new door and a new toilet out of the deal, which the door could have been squared without replacing it. Since then, I've done all the work on it. So I think it's been a pretty reliable trailer for all I've put it through.
Yeah.
Now, some people say Springdale's a crummy brand, and it's like, well, each his own. So, but again, it doesn't bother me to have to drive a screw in on the road that's working itself out. So people say, well, that's bad quality because they didn't torque the screw down tight enough or something. So,
yeah.
You know, what I like to tell people, it's like, you're taking a $30,000 house and you're driving it down the road at 60 miles an hour. What do you expect?
Yeah.
You know, if it's especially if you've been, you go over I-90 all the time or go to Ellensburg.
Oh, yeah.
That's the worst section of freeway in the United States. Yeah. I believe it's, yes, I have repaired fractured welds in my trailer and I blame it on I-90.
Oh yeah.
Because it's been over it so many times.
You go over one part of I-90 that I can almost every time I'm like, I need to be out of this lane because
lanes to shift out of coming up. Yeah. There's still this puddle of shift. That's a lot of impact. And I've can name three different times I've welded up my rig from, you know, I'm sure it's the impact of the expansion joints completely working on it. That's caused the steel to start to fatigue.
Crazy.
Luckily I have a welder. It's not a big deal for me. I got an extension cord. I wheel out in the driveway and I stitch it out and plate it, whatever is needed.
I've gone down I-90 with my drift boat. I'm like headed over guiding in the morning. Yeah. And I just like hit a bump and I swear my drift boat gets like,
I bet you the tires and wheels are off the ground. No doubt.
You can hear it.
Yeah.
Chains bouncing and all that. So yeah, that's crazy. But well, cool, Dave.
So other than like Airstream or the high end brands that really are manufacturers, I can't recommend one or the other.
Yeah. They're kind of all in the same class.
They're all assemblers in my book.
Yeah.
It's how well they do on the assembly, and that's all depend. And you know, the thing, you know, they're built by imperfect humans with imperfect materials in an imperfect world. Bottom line, there's going to be problems.
Yeah. No matter what you get, right?
There's nothing that's perfect. So,
yeah. Well, cool. We've had a really good conversation, kind of just diving in on dry camping and search and rescue. Was there anything else that you we didn't touch on that you think, hey, this is like something that the listeners should know?
You know, if they're really an RV, an RV is a great lifestyle if you tailor it to what you need. I like an RV. It's a magic carpet. It takes us to where we want to be and supplies what we need. If you think it's this owning an RV is going to be this magical thing, just make your life better, you're wrong. Just you got to use it. You got to have an outdoor interest like you would. To use it. You know, as people say, well, you know, we did one of our shows once we conducted a survey of why people RV'd. And we got this wife says, well, you know, I hate it because I can cook, clean, and do laundry at home. Why do I need an RV? Because that's all they went out and parked at a campground and she cooked, cleaned, and did dirty clothes. It's like, well, there's your problem. You need an outdoor interest that the RV supports. Yeah. It's a support vehicle. It's not an end to its own means. No.
It gives you a place to come and go while you're
at base camp. Everybody says, why don't you have, you know, why don't you want a TV in your rig? How come you don't have a slide out? It's a place to eat, sleep, and take refuge from the weather. Yeah. That's what an RV does. Because otherwise we're outside enjoying God's creation, whatever it might be, slot canyons, old ghost towns, mining camps, riding up to a high lookout, hiking, you know, whatever it is. But we're there for the outdoor experience, and the RV just facilitates that.
That's awesome. You said it best right there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, cool. Yeah. Well, awesome. Thanks for hopping on with me today.
You're welcome. You prompt me, I can talk all day long.
This has been awesome. And the stories throughout have been great too, you know? Well, cool. I'm going to do a little outro here and then we'll get going. So
sounds good.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks for hopping on the podcast with me today. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sure the listeners will find some value, you know, especially if they're going to buy a trailer, an RV, or anything of that. And then maybe people that own now have ideas on how to, you know, make their experience better. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
Just a couple of event updates coming up. I'm going to be doing a fly tying class probably at the start of May. I'll get more details posted on our social media about that. It's going to be I'm going for hoppers on this class. So this podcast might come out in May. So if this is past, I'm sorry, it's old information, but if it's relevant, then come out to my tying class. August 10th, the Cedar River cleanup. Make sure to come and show some support. Make sure we support these urban rivers and keeping them clean and enjoying the fisheries that we have locally to us. So If you can take the time on that day, there'll be giveaways, lunch. It's always a fun day, and it's a feel-good day for sure. Picking up, you know, I mean, we picked up over the, this is the 6th year, we've probably picked up hundreds of pounds of trash out of the river, and you can see it every day. But it's getting better, though. The first year we pulled out car bumpers, I mean, bikes, all types of stuff. So it's kind of down, dwindling down to like chew cans and beer bottles and stuff like that. So if you got the time, if you're looking for an adventure this summer, maybe you want to travel to Alaska or you want to come over to the Yakima and fish with me. We can do that. Kyle or I, you reach out to Bear Paw or Ellensburg Angler and we'll set you up with a trip. We'd love to have you out, and I'll be doing it on weekends. But I know Kyle's guiding like pretty much all week. So reach out to them if you're looking to book a trip with us. And yeah, we'd be grateful for that. So with that being said, this is another episode of the Young Guides Podcast. We want to just thank you one more time, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Great. Thanks.